We must speak the truth about terror. Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories, malicious lies that attempt to shift the blame away from the terrorists themselves.
Take your own advice.
What happens? I tell you what happens. Blam!
I have a window that looks directly at the World Trade Center, and I saw...
No collusion!
Shit's getting way too complicated for me. Yeah.
Welcome to The Antidote. This is Greg McCarron.
This is Jeremy Rothkuchel.
All right. It is today. It is July 14th, and we are here with a we're going to dig back into an important element of the, I think, of the Jeffrey Epstein, of all the situation surrounding Jeffrey Epstein. That's the case of John Mark Dugan, who was a sheriff's deputy in South Florida, who basically relocated to Russia, permanently lives in Russia, and took off, it appears, with a good portion of material that the that had been compiled about Jeffrey Epstein. And we're going to dig into Dugan, his relationship with Pavel Barodin, correct?
Yes, and that will be probably the next chapter that we cover. We're going to go back one chapter to deal with some background context about the question of where is the kompromat.
Okay, so this is going to be a bit of like a, I guess this is going to be a bit of a preview of that. It's going to be more of a background, and then we'll specifically get into the topic of Dugan and Barodin after we read from this chapter from American Kompromat by Craig Unger. So we're going to, this is going to be a lead up of sorts that, but what we're going to be looking to accomplish with this is to really dig deeply into this question of Dugan and Epstein and Russia, and then even going back into the Trump Jeffrey Epstein history.
Yes, and especially as like the I keep hearing this line being pushed all around alt media, and I've heard it twice, actually almost like directly in my audio presence in these Twitter spaces. One was from Edward Zoll, formerly of True News, who came in when I was making the case about why I believe that the Trump Katie Johnson story was true, and started with a line about how everyone's always it almost sounds like this is like almost like a written talking point. And to some extent, it might be. It does look like that. It's comes out of Whitney Webb's work, when she's been going around to the podcast. She's always focuses on first and foremost. Everyone talks about what she calls like the salacious sex part of this, but the real deeper story is about the financial crimes, right? Okay, now obviously the financial crimes are part and parcel of what's going on here in terms of what Epstein was an international, you know, multi-state, deep state bagman of some sort, and a fixer and a compromiser. But the sexual compromise part of this is not, it's very substantial and it's very important. And, you know, financial crimes, sure, they're a big deal. And, you know, especially when organized around deep state politics. But really, where the rubber meets the road in terms of making some of the richest and most powerful people in the world, you know, stick to a line when big things come up, let's say 9/11, let's say the Iraq War, let's even say COVID, you know, when those kinds of things happen, the thing that can actually create immediate leverage is the threat of exposure of what is seen around the world as some of the most horrific, both morally and criminally, crimes, which is the sexual abuse of minors, of children. And so when that kind of thing is hidden and then implied as a threat, it doesn't have to be rolled out every time. That's why people sort of make it sort of simplistic. Like it's, you know, every time that the Epstein Maxwell network wants something from someone, they'll roll out the video, don't make us expose you. No, it's then implied. It becomes a sort of the sealing of the blood deal of some kind of omerta of some sort. And this is why it's so important that the Epstein Trump, you know, that they are directly implicated in what Katie Johnson is alleged against them, together in person in real life, and not only against one underage girl. There was this Maria girl who Wayne Madsen and his journalistic partners went and tracked down, and there's a very real journalistically backed evidence case around Maria as a real missing girl and very much implicated in what Katie Johnson was saying in terms of this cultivated network in that case surrounding New York City in the early 90s. Then I heard the same line after Ed Zoll rolled it out. Everyone's talking about the sort of the sex stuff. And this is after he denied, he's like, I looked into it. There's nothing there with Trump and Epstein and Katie Johnson. It was a totally manufactured thing. Then, you know, that everyone makes this all about, the sex crimes and distracts from the financial crimes. And then a neo-MAGA GOP operative from Idaho was in a more recent space and said the exact same line when I brought it up again.
It's interesting because I don't know about this particular, but this particular person who you described as being neo-MAGA, trying to sell on the virtuous state of Idaho with the neocons being kicked out of Idaho and all this and replaced by actual conservative patriots. I'm a bit wary of that narrative. But I do know in the case of like True News that, boy, those types are all about using Jeffrey Epstein's sex crimes against him when it could be, you know, the stuff that's alleged and the stuff that actually happened. And when it comes to like the Clintons or other like prominent, you know, deep state or so, then in this case, like, well, it's a distraction from the financial crime.
Yeah. And
so it seems interesting.
And as like the 2014, campaign gets going here in summer of 2023, and the DeSantis campaign seems to be sort of heading down to some extent. He's not ready for prime time. And the Trump campaign is still as strong as it ever has been, even while he's under national security indictment, and there's continuing questions of, January 6 related cases, election attack related cases coming into the fold, and meanwhile, the MAGA base is more sort of devoutly, behind Trump than ever before, to some extent, and especially with the relationship of Q and the rolling out of the big movie with Jim Caviezel and that whole suspicious network behind it. Seb Solomon has been highlighting about how, this Carlos Slim's son is involved in the background there. There is a crypto company that's platforming it. It looks like online, maybe around the world. And so there's a lot of suspicions there. And of course, the quote unquote whistleblower and all of that is Homeland Security.
With a close tie with the organization that was founded by Glenn Beck and all that that entails, there's obviously some some problematic elements there. And then also I saw a clip of Jim Caviezel, who plays the role of Ballard in this Sound of Freedom, saying that in so many words that like almost that Trump was anointed president by God to fight sex trafficking and child trafficking, and that this movie was almost like for him. Like, that's the impression I got. I'll share the clip in the I can share this clip in the show notes. That was my impression of like, and this guy is very probably the most QAnon friendly celebrity in Hollywood, I'd say. Like, he openly pushes adrenochrome and all this, and he's basically saying on Steve Bannon's War Room that this is like, you know, this movie is a thank you to Trump for all he did for to fight child trafficking, and that God put Trump in place to do this. So,
right. And if there's been any single presidential candidate, let alone a president, who has the most documented background of being involved in aspects of trafficking, especially around sex trafficking, it's got to be Donald Trump and his modeling network and how deeply involved he was with Epstein. And we know about the front that these quote unquote international modeling companies were in terms of human trafficking. So when you combine that background with what I think we have to continue to really dig down into in terms of, are the Katie Johnson allegations, damning as they are, true or not? Are they credible or not? And the more I see, the more credible they seem to me. And this becomes more and more important because it's obvious that this is the Achilles heel of this whole increasingly religiously devout cult that I think is very dangerous. And so I think that it's very important to expose this, especially as the Achilles heel of someone that's being propped up as some kind of religious figure. And I think even The Economist magazine just recently published a cover story featuring Trump's disturbing plans for Trump's second term, and basically quoting from the sort of making biblical references to all of that. And so this becomes a crucial piece, is to at the very least, like, force them to sort of make some kind of argument about how this Trump is like King David or something like that, where he made quote unquote mistakes in the past, but now he used to be blind, but now he can see or something like that, but force them to deal with the actual criminality, including in terms of human trafficking and sexual compromise and sexual crimes against minors of their religious icon here, Donald Trump.
And as the narratives become more and more weaponized, as they become more and more divisive and more out there as we go on, as things get escalated, you go from what became Pizzagate, what became QAnon, and now, as you mentioned, this is sort of kind of a mainstreaming of what was before Fringe Q through this Sound of Freedom. And that's where, like, you have all these people from Alex Jones to whoever else, like, having on-air tantrums about negative reviews of Sound of Freedom. And it's not because, oh, they're exposing child trafficking. No, it's because of how films like this are being used and how they're being marketed and the dangerous consequences of how they're being marketed, not because of the films themselves. I mean, it becomes more consequential, and it becomes more, as the stakes get risen, the possibility of this Trump return, and like, heaven forbid what could go on in the case of like a second Trump presidency. And also just in terms of like, now, like, we are seeing these things increasingly mainstreamed as we move on from Q and Pizzagate to, this is all lumped in with the supposed grooming agenda and the people who want to, the degenerates and perverts who want to defile and destroy your children. So, I mean, this is all being lumped together, and it is this narrative of like, you're fighting literal, what was at one point seen on the fringes as QAnon, although it was always promoted and put out there by significant people, just not to the level that it is now. It is this mainstreaming of like, of this literal spiritual warfare against literal evil, where Donald Trump is like this religious level figure who's standing up to this, and he's being persecuted and targeted by the spiritually wicked and evil elements for doing so.
Yes. And, and I think you're exactly right that this is the mainstreaming of the Q op, Q and anonymous op. It's clear Caviezel is read in on the Q Anon operation, and he's even been talking obviously about the adrenochrome wherever he goes, which is sort of making sensations in the sort of alt-right, MAGA-right Q communities.
He's also tied in Ukraine to this, that there's adrenochrome in these bio labs in Ukraine. So not only are there bio labs, but the bio labs is where adrenochrome is being harvested.
This is wild. This is sort of really escalating to some extent. And now the other point I want to make is that the film, what's it called? Sound of Freedom?
The Sound of Freedom, yes.
The Sound of Freedom is focused around this alleged DHS whistleblower story around the southern border, right? And human trafficking out of Mexico. Now, it's obvious that that is a serious issue in terms of, you know, trafficking that is related to Central America and then, you know, border issues. But it's very obvious that this is then there's this whole border thing. Remember, that's why War Room is a key one, right? Where did Bannon get indicted around was using, you know, a quote unquote private approach to building the wall to actually, you know, funnel funds to his interests, right? So there's a whole thing, right? Build the wall, key component of the neuro-linguistic programming, psychological operations surrounding the Trump campaign. And it's a key place that they like to focus on. And now, meanwhile, if you want to talk about the, you know, human trafficking at the layer where it actually reaches people like the Clintons and the Trumps, you have to then look at New York City then and Florida and the modeling operations, the modeling front companies, where then you're then trafficking, you know, girls and young women from Eastern Europe and Russia and that whole area over there, and then they become, you know, wrapped up in these scenes and in terms of these big net and powerful individuals and private jets and all of that. So once again, similarly, like we pointed out, that even surrounding the Epstein Maxwell narrative during the Trump years, where there was an early push, even by Trump himself during the 2016 campaign with Hannity on stage
at
CPAC, to be like, well, Clinton is going to have a problem with the island, right? The island. And we pointed out at the time, yes, the island, yes, the, you know, the quote unquote Lolita Express, Epstein's airplane, but also the brownstone in New York City that was pre-wired for audiovisual quote unquote security, AKA Compromat, by the Les Wexner crew before it was then handed over to what the Ohio General Inspector General Sturtz called the boyfriend, Jeffrey Epstein, who then the timing is very solid in terms of Katie Johnson's allegations of 1994. Of it sounds like it's at this property, right, where the alleged rape by Trump and Epstein took place. And remember, there's also an allegation of threat to not talk about this ever again. All right, so there's a lot there, and so we should get into the background of financial crimes. Yes, trace the financial crimes. That's a key piece of this. But don't try to downplay the importance of the sexual crimes, the abuse, the abuse of underage, you know, of children, really, of minors, and especially then how then that is then coupled into mass political compromat, in the point of where are these audiovisual recordings of these compromising criminal and wicked acts. So that's what we're going to start getting into. Greg, do you want to make any points about Craig Unger? This is Craig Unger's book, American Compromat, How the KGB Cultivated Donald Trump and Related Tales of Sex, Greed, Power, and Treachery.
Yeah, there's a little more that I would, I don't know motivations or what an MO would be behind the types of books that Unger has been known for writing over the past, I guess, better part of two decades, like going back to the Bush era. It's these like he writes these very deep and I would say maybe authoritative volumes on these particular figures of influence in these going back to his interest. He wrote House of Bush, House of Saud, about the Bush family and the Saudi Arabian royals back in the in the Bush days. Then he wrote, post-Bush, he wrote a book called Boss Rove, which really, among other things, went into detail about Karl Rove's role in Ohio in 2004. And then in the Trump days, he's written first House of Trump, House of Putin, and then the book we're going to be reading from, American Compromise. So I find his volumes of work interesting. And just a note on the Bush, the House of Bush House of Saud book is that I find it interesting because you know, we are beginning to look at certain things regarding the Bush family, and particularly George H.W. Bush, in a bit of a more in a light I think we're going to try to lay out in future shows at some point regarding things all the way from September 11th to Bush's relationship with the neocons. And it is interesting that he comes out with this book that very much focuses on this on you, what you might say is the, I mean, people would say maybe limited hangout, but in terms of this public pinning of September 11th, if anybody had culpability, you know, it's the Saudis, royals, and their powerful friends, the Bush family. And so it's interesting that he came out with this in the height of the Bush era. But then, like, so he is like, seems like maybe is there to write deep volumes on certain Republican political figures. But it's interesting the trajectory from Bush and Saudi Arabia to Trump and Russia, and then to American Compromise, and then what might be a missing element, you mentioned, what is the relationship that Craig Unger maybe has with Israel. So he's definitely an interesting place to write these volumes and books. And not to say, of course, like, you know, House of Bush, House of Saud is nothing or anything, but it's interesting that this is out there with all these other volumes and narratives out there that basically did publicly put the blame for 9/11 on Saudi Arabia royals and their, by extension, their powerful friends in the Bush family.
Yeah, and I think what we've seen is that there is a very interesting analog between the cover-up of 9/11 to the cover-up of 11/9. And in certain ways, the, you know, Unger's work post 9/11 during the George W. Bush years sort of played on the big meme that we got about the quote unquote expose of 9/11 by Michael Moore, Fahrenheit 9/11, which is where we then came up with this shorthand of then 11/9, because Michael Moore then produced a film, Fahrenheit 11/9. So that is an indicator of another deep event, not only because it represents the date that Trump was announced president after midnight, after the election in 2016, but it also means that there is a very likely a similar kind of cover-up around a similarly expansive kind of deep event. And Michael Moore was crucial to actually laying out what we would might call the limited hangout, I think, approach to 9/11 of it. This all came down to some kind of maybe nebulous and suspicious closeness of ties between the Bush family and the Bin Ladens, and then combine that with Bush sort of playing golf too much and hacking too much brush down at his ranch in Texas or something like that, with just a little sprinkling of, you know, are there ulterior motives? May they have let it happen because it serviced them? And meanwhile, not a single mention of Michael Moore's, you know, the country to which Michael Moore's agent's father was an operative of. You know, we're talking about the you know, the Irgun and early where Israeli military and intelligence comes from in terms of these proto-Israeli terrorist squads that some may call freedom fighters or whatever. And so I think that Unger, you have to consider that there is this aspect with Unger where he's a very good journalist. He provides a lot of facts. He does a lot of digging. He was one of the people who did some of the early digging around the fight. You want to look at the financial crimes there. He dug into the financial crimes surrounding the Trump real estate and the Russian organized crime money laundering via Trump real estate, and he tracked down a lot of that. But meanwhile, from 9/11 to 11/9, it is obvious that Unger and his milieu, they limit the hangout on the Israeli component of both 9/11 and 11/9. And so it's the, I think we can very similarly sort of see a parallel where with 9/11, you basically have this sort of the limited hangout version of look at the Saudis. They did this, the Bushes are covering up for them or something like that. And then when you deal with the Israeli component, it's almost virtually 2-1, maybe totally 2-1. You have these problems of, Willis Carto associated people, alt-right sort of, verging on neo-Nazi associated people. When you think about documentaries that were made or people like, what became of like people like Mike Delaney and his, Missing Links, or then you get to the people like Ryan Dawson and those types where there's a very strong Russian intelligence, angle to that sort of, umbrelling the whole matter. And so I think we see something similar with 11/9.
That's a great point. And when you say Willis Carto, you're referring specifically to outlets such as the Spotlight magazine or American Free Press, which both Christopher Bolin of Israel 9/11 wrote a very, I think, major volume on that. And then Michael Collins Piper, who's written the major volume of Israel and John F. Kennedy assassination, both came from that. And that's basically American right-wing nationalist, quote-unquote, some people might say more, neo-Nazi, definitely in the racial and serious, like centric direction. And so that's where anytime you get like these serious things about Israel, like it's always or about like or Zionism or whatever, or even elements related to critical aspects of Jewish history, it seems to come from these places like this and are very toxified and weaponized, obviously much more overtly with like, what you mentioned, Mike Delaney and stuff. And then also on the flip side of that, the definitive, history of like even going back to things like the slave trade is from the Nation of Islam and Louis Farrakhan's group. So it's like, it's a mess all around. And then like these other areas are filled in, the more quote unquote respectable people will not, for a number of reasons, are tending to deal with these other things and not get into these deep political matters around Israel. So it creates an interesting dynamic there. And then the horseshoe of these Russophilic types and like this alt-right Israel did 11 crew. And then the other side of that, which would be the people who just really focus on Russia, but stay away from Israel, deal with it less for a number of reasons, ranging from maybe fear or some type of ideological blind spot to just deliberate limiting of hangouts. So yeah, it's interesting all around. It needs to be, I think, looked at more going forward. And I think that is something we're going to focus on in the future.
Definitely. And the question of the what's spawned by the Willis Carto network, I think is a very important, issue, especially for those in deep politics who cover issues of Jewish power, Zionism, the Israeli state and covert operations and all of that, and how much has come, how many memes and information, how much information has come out of that network. And we will continue to look at that. And especially like this figure of this Francis Parker Yockey, who in many ways is like the archetypal a few generations ago, the Nazbol, basically the Nazi Bolshevik type, who was suspected by U.S. intelligence of being an agent of maybe multiple different foreign interests, and he was a crucial figure for Willis Carto. And so there's a lot there, I think, to unpack in terms of counterintelligence and deep politics, and maybe ideology, the role that ideology works as a frame to both maybe dirty up some of these issues while also then distracting from others. And so, just to be fair to Unger, he doesn't. It's not like he fully whitewashes any Israeli connections. He actually deals with some of them. And in both of his books about what we would call 11/9, in terms of House of Trump, House of Putin, he does a fairly good analysis of the the Russian-Israeli oligarchs that surround these power sets and connect Putin and then Trump networks and Netanyahu. But it is all done under the frame of, you know, Nancy Pelosi's all roads lead to Putin in a certain way. And so there is that framework there just to sort of be fair, even though Unger does provide crucial evidence that then ties in to the Israeli sphere. All right.
Go ahead.
All right, let's get into this. Chapter 14, Who's Got the Kompromat, from Craig Unger's American Kompromat. All right, this is page 208. Quote, at a time when Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell were courting the titans of Wall Street and Silicon Valley, internationally known academics and European royalty, they were also injecting the virus of human trafficking into the American body politic and weaponizing it in the form of dirty little secrets of the richest and most powerful people in the world. But exactly who used these secrets as leverage and against whom was unclear. Were they using the girls as perks to woo new clients, lending them out like trinkets to entertain billionaires? Were they using them as leverage, extortion perhaps, by keeping sex videos as potential blackmail? Were they trading them to foreign intelligence services in Israel or Russia? No one really knew. Some men close to Epstein actually said they thought that what was going on was far more innocent than the press has made it out to be. According to Mother Jones, Stuart Pivar, a scientist and co-founder of the New York Academy of Art, who also served as Epstein's longtime friend and art advisor, said Jeffrey was suffering from satriasis, an affliction characterized by an insatiable sexual appetite. Unquote. Now, this is interesting. Pivar, who I believe is then also in the middle of what became the original contention between people like Maria Farmer and Kirby Summers in terms of the New York Academy of Art. Pivar is a crucial figure in all of this in terms of his closeness to Epstein. So it's interesting to try to hear him explain it away as a sort of a psychological or psychiatric condition. I would just point out, though, that this kind of potential psychological condition is also some evidence potentially of Epstein being MK Ultra, potentially, right? Because that becomes a signal that the psyche has been broken, and then that in order to sort of feel whole on a daily basis, it needs these sort of quick sexual pleasures. So there's an interesting piece there.
That's a good point. And this is me spitballing. I don't have any evidence to back this up. But when you mentioned MKUltra, it made me think about Jeffrey Epstein being put into this position at this Dalton school, and Donald Barr, William Barr's father, and all these strange volumes he wrote about, like, what, some intergalactic sex and stuff. Like, it makes you, I mean, I thought of that.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, maybe early last year, Kirby Summers was investigating the deeper aspects of Epstein's growing up and the relationship early on to him identified as a gifted child, and then the interlocking gifted music program and his father's position. And so there is some there that she, I think, has published publicly, that's not behind a paywall, that would be helpful for those who are interested in pursuing this question of potentially the deeper MK Ultra, let's say, type background that is suggested by Epstein's upbringing, including what you pointed out about Donald Barr and his strange publishing and background and all that.
And also on the topic of gifted and talented programs in general, recluse, Stephen Snyder's been doing some very useful research and has talked about that on various platforms of the gifted and talented program and how it's been used over the last century or so.
Definitely. Yeah. And maybe we should link to an episode that Recluse did about that matter. It's very, very interesting, and it's important in terms of tracing this history about how people are cultivated and targeted and all of that, and especially in terms of the U.S. system. All right, back to page 208 of American Kompromat by Craig Unger, the chapter Who's Got the Kompromat? Quote, "There was no grand strategy behind Epstein's operation, another associate of his told me, insisting that what was going on was merely that a bunch of rich guys were constantly looking for girls for their own pleasure and amusement. Epstein's massive homes in New Mexico, on his Caribbean island, in his East Side mansion, were all part of an operation that was really just a latter-day version of Hugh Hefner's Playboy Mansion, but on steroids." Unquote. By the way, there's, you know, more increasing investigation into what Hugh Hefner's Playboy Mansion was, where that was, it's not even as simplistic in terms of what Unger is sort of writing in terms of what some of these sources are trying to justify to him, and that the Hefner operation is also associated with something like potential kompromat and related to things like sex slavery and MKUltra and all of that too. So that I don't think that's an explanation per se. Okay. Page 209 of American Kompromat by Craig Unger. Quote, "In other places, in other times, rich and powerful men would gather in wood-paneled, smoke-filled rooms and trade tall tales over fine whiskey and cohibas. Jeffrey was offering up young girls instead. But that rationale doesn't quite work. For one thing, there was no reason to doubt that Ghislaine and Jeffrey regularly documented the sexual escapades of their guests. Christina Oxenberg told me that Ghislaine had told her about the videos in 1997. In 2015, Virginia Roberts Gouffre filed an affidavit in court asserting that she believed federal prosecutors had videos and photos of her, quote, as an underage girl having sex with Epstein and some of his powerful friends," unquote. And by the way, I think the question of, you know, of Virginia Gouffre immediately takes us into the question of the Epstein-Maxwell cover-up and the lawyers and the Boys Network and Brad Edwards and Stanley Pottinger. And by the way, it's interesting, I have certain beef, obviously, with Johnny Vedmore, and especially in terms of aspects of the way that he presents things and his analyses, and some of it tied into Whitney Webb's analysis. But it looks like he has just released a very interesting write-up about Pottinger and the background of Stanley Pottinger and how it relates to this legal part of the Epstein-Maxwell cover-up that we started, covering early last year, in terms of really pointing out that this Boys Network, Pottinger himself, the background of how Brad Edwards says that he got into the case in the first place, how he then got in bed with Boys and Pottinger, shows that this is some kind of deep operation, not some kind of actual, like, trying to get to the bottom of this or protect the victims or any of that. So there is a key piece there that needs to continue to be unpacked about, especially probably about Pottinger, because he then connects, as we pointed out, back through things like Iran-Contra. And then I would still assert it looks like he might have even been part of the Iran operation that included actually helping install Khomeini and very likely generate the Iranian hostage crisis, which was really the big made-for-TV sort of launching of the modern war on terror in many ways for an American audience. And just thinking about it in terms of, you know, years, late 70s, the 79 Jerusalem conference, this is all happening concomitantly. All right. Back to page 209 of American Kompromat by Craig Unger. Quote, "There was the Epstein acquaintance who told me Epstein had shown him photos of Donald Trump with young girls. And in 2019, according to Bloomberg News, after the FBI raided Epstein's Upper East Side mansion, prosecutors said that FBI agents had assembled a, quote, vast trove of lewd photographs of young-looking women or girls, unquote, as well as compact discs labeled, quote, miscellaneous nudes 1, unquote, and, quote, girls pics nude, unquote. All right, unquote. Just one other thing here. This is another line that's being pushed. You see these memes sort of similarly to the meme that's been generated to talk about, you know, focus on the financial crimes, not the the sexual compromat crimes, is that there's also the focus on the list, right? The Jeffrey Epstein list. I think that's a directly generated meme to distract away from, no, the actual compromat. Where are the audio visuals, right? This is now there's, you know, it's report, obviously FBI took these into their custody, but where else are these actual, who has the compromat?
Yes, I think you're right. This is much more significant than lists, which can include anyone and everyone who ever like did anything. Even basically it just goes from people directly associated, so maybe somebody who was, you know, maybe had a remote affiliation with something related to Epstein at one point or another. And it just creates all this endless speculation and who is, the intrigue around who's on the list. And of course, like, it always stays away from the, you know, from the Trump family, of course, and those interests. But the endless, meanwhile, like, this is where the actual serious stuff is. It's not on lists of like, of everybody, you know, any celebrity or anybody who's of any type of prominence and that may have had something to do. And not to say that shouldn't be scrutinized, because, but like, this is way more consequential than lists of people who may have been involved in something at some point with them who just happened to be famous. And then it just creates all this nonstop speculation of who did what and all this. Meanwhile, like, this is where like serious stuff would be contained.
Exactly. All right, middle of page 209 of American Compromat by Craig Unger. Quote, there was no doubt that this was compromat on a grand scale, but so many questions about it were unanswered, and there was always the possibility that Epstein's operation itself was not secure. A former deputy sheriff in the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office told me he had possession of more than 400 videos that were presumably taken by Epstein and Ghislaine. Epstein's lawyers, and there were many of them, presumably had access to the materials or at least knew some of their contents. So did prosecutors and their investigators. Moreover, exactly who was in these videos, who had been compromised, has never been fully revealed. As noted, Epstein's black book and his plane's flight logs listed hundreds of celebrities and power brokers of one sort or another. Between them, the two documents, also as noted, showed that Bill Clinton and Donald Trump, former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, billionaire industrialist David Koch, and countless other luminaries had hitched rides with Epstein on the Lolita Express. There were also scores of celebrities from the worlds of art, entertainment, and media, including Mick Jagger, Alec Baldwin, Courtney Love, and Charlie Rose. Not to mention less glamorous but nonetheless powerful titans of the media industry, Wall Street, and politics. In addition to his huge operation on Little St. James, Epstein oversaw an equally elaborate operation in his East 71st Street mansion in New York and maintained a special set of apartments to house the girls just a few blocks away. Then, of course, there were his massive homes in New Mexico, Paris, and elsewhere. Scores of people worked for him and could not fail to notice the nude photos, erotica, dildos, and sex toys, not to mention all the tall, lithe, attractive young girls. The girls themselves knew what was happening, or at least parts of the story, and there were hundreds of them. The Black Book alone listed dozens of masseuses in New York, Paris, New Mexico, the Virgin Islands, and other locales. With Ghislaine at the top of Epstein's, quote, sexual pyramid scheme, unquote, dozens of girls like Virginia Gouffre serviced Epstein and then recruited others to do the same. Courtney Wilde, in the Netflix documentary Jeffrey Epstein, Filthy Rich, claims she was first molested by Epstein when she was 14 and subsequently brought Epstein 40 to 60 girls, for which she was paid $200 each. Girls including Leslie Groff, Sarah Kellen, Nadia Marchenkova, and Adriana Ross recruited others as well. Giuffre has given sworn testimony about her alleged sexual encounters with Epstein, Prince Andrew, and Alan Dershowitz. The other girls she worked with told similar stories, and so did the girls who recruited them all the way to the top of the pyramid. In addition, there was Jean-Luc Brunel, his quote-unquote models, and his staff at MC2, and Peter Listerman, who had direct ties to the FSB and firsthand experience dealing with sexual espionage, Russian style. But when all was said and done, it was still unclear who had been captured on the videos, who had actual possession of them, and how they might be used. Had Epstein hidden them before he was taken into custody in 2008? Were they locked down in the custody of law enforcement officers and attorneys? Had Ghislaine hidden them? Were they seized by the sheriff's office, the FBI? And who would be interested in such compromat? Wall Street insiders, for sure. Israel was another possibility. Former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak had allegedly been seen with both Robert Maxwell and Epstein shortly before Maxwell's death in 1991. Interesting. And he later got financing from Epstein for Carbine, a company he started that handles emergency response services. Barak had been a visitor to Jeffrey Epstein's Upper East Side residence in 2016. The Saudis were another possibility. That photo of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, aka MBS, was not there just for show, as one Epstein associate told me. They were genuinely close friends. There was also Iran, the United Kingdom, and of course Russia, which realized that the rewards were potentially huge. In addition to Listerman, Russia had ties to Epstein through dozens of girls from the former Soviet Union who were participating in the Epstein operation. Reached by text in October 2020, shortly before publication, Listerman wrote back that he was suffering from COVID-19 and would not be able to respond to my questions until after the book's deadline.
Hmm.
In the past, according to the New York Post, he has told reporters, quote, "I'm not a pimp, just a matchmaker," unquote. End of section. We're at towards the bottom of page 211 of American Compromat by Craig Unger. And just by the way, going back to Barak and Robert Maxwell and Epstein shortly before Maxwell's death in 1991, that's very interesting. And then, of course, the Carbine 911 connection to Barak and Epstein also then, of course, ropes in a bunch of other people, right? You're talking about Michael Chertoff and Peter Thiel and Victor Vexelberg and Lital Hashem, Nicole Junkerman, alongside the, you know, a company basically run by Israeli military intelligence veterans. And this is meant to be a rolled out as a replacement for the United States, especially in terms of a replacement for all of our 911 emergency response systems that then basically looks like turn it into some kind of back-ended, smartphoneification using back ends of people sort of calling in for help and all of that. So you begin to sort of see that there is a major technology component, especially to the Israeli interest in the Epstein-Maxwell network and their involvement in Silicon Valley.
Yes, and I think that all of this around the person Ehud Barak, it's interesting that in this time with the very obvious chilliness with the Biden administration and the Netanyahu government even though the president, Isaac Herzog, is going to speak to a joint session of Congress next week, like think it's pretty significant that it's not Netanyahu, and he has not in 2.5 years. He's been, you know, with the exception of the period when he wasn't prime minister, like he's been in there at the beginning of the administration. He's been in there for the last 9 months or so, 8 to 9 months, and he has not even received so much as an invite from the White House. And I think this is the longest time an American president and Israeli prime minister have not formally met. And in this period of like all this stuff that's going on here, it is interesting that Ehud Barak became like a voice for the opposition to the overhauling of the judicial system in Israel, the changes taking place within the new Netanyahu government. So I think that's something to consider, keep an eye on in terms of what is the, you know, what is the MO? I don't know what it is, but like, it's a good question. What is the MO of like a Ehud Barak setting himself up as public opposition to leading public opposition to this and the supporter of the people in the streets who are demanding changes and going back and overturning this shifting in Israeli society. So that's a very interesting question, especially we look at like September 11th as almost like Netanyahu and Barak to differing extents, kind of like working together on the legend around 9/11 and the post-September 11th narrative for sure, and Barak on the BBC and Netanyahu basically demanding the U.S. go to war with Iraq and in House hearings. And so I think it's a very interesting question.
Definitely. The moment right now is very interesting when you see the Israel lobby, real like Hasbara types directly stating in public that they're claiming that Biden treats Iran better than Israel at this time. Okay. So that is indicative of the political times in terms of the current U.S. administration, I would say. All right. All right, we are heading to the bottom of page 211 of American Compromise by Craig Unger. Quote, Epstein's ascent as a philanthropist in science and technology started even before he had been convicted for soliciting minors and served time. But after he got out of jail in 2009, the zeal with which the most prestigious academic institutions in the world accepted his largesse became vital to his quest to rehabilitate his reputation. In 2003, the Jeffrey Epstein Six Foundation, VI as in Virgin Islands, established the Program for Evolutionary Dynamics, PED, that's interesting, at Harvard, and Epstein donated $6.5 million to the program that year, the largest single donation he made to Harvard. After serving only 13 months of an 18-month sentence in prison for procuring a girl under the age of 18 for prostitution, he began using his association with Harvard and PED to rehabilitate his image, and according to a review by Harvard's Faculty of Arts and Sciences, likely made more than 40 visits to the PED office in Cambridge to that end. According to the Harvard Crimson, the report also found that mathematics and biology professor Martin A. Nowak approved posting, quote, flattering and false descriptions of Epstein's philanthropy and support of Harvard, unquote. Nowak was put on paid administrative leave as a result. Starting in 2011, 3 years after his conviction, Epstein began meeting occasionally with Bill Gates, who, according to the New York Times, visited Epstein's 71st Street townhouse at least 3 times, staying into the night on one occasion. Employees of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation went there as well. Epstein had begun discussions with the Gates Foundation and J.P. Morgan Chase about overseeing a proposed multi-billion-dollar philanthropic fund, an arrangement that could potentially be enormously lucrative for Epstein. Unquote. Just quick aside here, obviously, is that, you know, this is also part of a cover up, right? Talking about how Epstein and Gates really got going post his first arrest and sentence 2011. Now, meanwhile, it's pretty clear from media reports that have been scrubbed from before that by the turn of the millennium, Bill Gates and Epstein were already close, and that Gates, along with Trump and I think Wexner, had been identified as the crucial figures to Epstein's support and backing. And of course, this again, you know, remember Alan Dershowitz's claim about Giuffre's allegations, which he said were false, was that Giuffre had been confusing Dershowitz maybe with the former chief technology officer of Microsoft, Nathan Myhrvold, who had been on a trip to Russia with Epstein. So this whole Microsoft and Bill Gates Epstein relationship goes way back before a sort of post convicted Epstein.
Yeah. And I think it's pretty instructive that as much like mystery and maybe deliberate, confusion around like the timeline of Gates's history with Epstein and how far it may or may not go back. It's interesting that all of these names, like it's acceptable to really have the critical discourse commentary about their relationships with Epstein, all except for Donald Trump, who the, you know, quote, alt media ignores and downplays or denies. And then the, you know, the MSM, which just doesn't go in the directions that are needed to go with him either. Yet all these other narratives are so prevalent and constantly heard about, except for the Trump one, which for different reasons is obfuscated and downplayed and not dealt with where it needs to be dealt with by both the, you know, what's called the MSM and then the quote conspiracy friendly alternative media. So, or like the more and all that that entails. It's interesting.
Definitely. Very much. All right. Top of page 2012, towards the top of page 2012 of American Compromise by Craig Unger. Quote, employees of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation went there as well. This is Epstein's 71st Street townhouse, the Wexner Town brownstone in New York, in Manhattan. Quote, employees of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation went there as well. Epstein had begun discussions with the Gates Foundation and J.P. Morgan Chase about overseeing a proposed multi-billion dollar philanthropic fund, an arrangement that could potentially be enormously lucrative for Epstein. Unquote. And but by the way, Whitney Webb has done some recent articles have been about exploring the Epstein Maxwell network background of the rise of Jamie Dimon, actually. So the sort of filling out some of this JP Morgan Chase background here. Quote, before long, Epstein had carved out a serious reputation for himself as a science and technology philanthropist. His credentials helped. A former member of the New York Academy of Science and a board member of Rockefeller University, he had also served on the advisory board of the Harvard Society for Mind, Brain, and Behavior. With tall young girls everywhere, most often blonde, and his bathroom stocked with penis and vagina-shaped soaps, Epstein had created a world that served two wildly differing purposes. In addition to being the site of his sexual massages, often three times a day, and sex parties, Little St. James was home to the Jeffrey Epstein VI Foundation, which Epstein endowed with a $30 million grant affiliated with Harvard, and hosted conferences on medical research, theoretical physics, string theory, and the like with world-renowned scientists such as Stephen Hawking. In January 2012, the Jeffrey Epstein VI Foundation announced its sponsorship of a conference organized by MIT's Marvin Minsky, a pioneer in artificial intelligence, with the headline, quote, Top Scientists Meet to Discuss Greatest Threats to the Earth, unquote. A key figure at MIT's artificial intelligence lab, Minsky, according to The Verge, co-wrote with Seymour Papert a groundbreaking 1969 book on self-training algorithms, perceptrons, and later developed a computer display that was a forerunner to modern virtual reality and augmented reality systems. 2.5 months later, in late March, the Jeffrey Epstein VI Foundation put out a press release declaring, quote, science philanthropist Jeffrey Epstein convenes a conference of Nobel laureates to define gravity, unquote. In April, his foundation put out yet another bulletin, quote, Jeffrey Epstein, science philanthropist, organizes a global doomsday conference, unquote. In 2013, he told journalist Edward J. Epstein that he was funding a group in Hong Kong that was building the world's smartest robot. In 2014, he funded NeuroTV, an online network devoted to neuroscience. In 2015, as Gabriel Sherman reported in Vanity Fair, LinkedIn co-founder Reid Hoffman, who later apologized for his role in rehabilitating Epstein's image, brought Epstein out to Palo Alto, California, for dinner with Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, and Peter Thiel, among others. Epstein had wormed his way into Musk's world after he initiated regular contact with Kimball Musk, who serves on the boards of two of his brother Elon's companies, Tesla and SpaceX, and whom Epstein introduced to a woman he had previously dated. Unquote. I just want to say that folks who are interested in maybe some of the deeper analysis of the background of Epstein, Maxwell, and Silicon Valley, and specifically of Elon Musk, should go look at Carrie Kukral's Twitter feed, where she has had direct background there in terms of being sort of cultivated in a sort of in a relationship kind of way by the key sort of legacy Silicon Valley quote unquote venture capitalist Steve Jurvetson. So we will link her Twitter feed for those who want to look into a deeper telling of this story than Unger's providing.
You know, it's interesting that I had mentioned just now, like the focus on all these other elements of Epstein and then like the lack around Trump. But it is interesting that this book, or at least these chapters of American Compromise, are going into like this. And there's things that are missing, of course. But as far as like a general history of like Epstein rehabilitating is and the, you know, financial and other elements that go along with Epstein and some of the people involved with him and the rehabilitating of his image post his scandals and trials in the 2000s, that this gets into that. And then based on the next chapter, it's going to really get into the specifics surrounding the Epstein-Trump relationship. So this is one of the, you know, this is definitely, I think, a volume that appears to look at both directions in terms of like these all this stuff that's out there that is, I would say, probably conventional wisdom in a large portion of what we call alternative media and increasingly in certain mainstream areas, and then bringing in like this other Epstein Trump history. So that it does, this does, there is a focus on both here of like these other names and then of the specific Trump history. So I am noticing that out of what we're reading here and what we're going to read in the next chapter.
All right. And we are in middle of page 213 of American Compromat by Craig Unger. I'll reread this part. Quote, Epstein had wormed his way into Musk's world after he initiated regular contact with Kimball Musk, who serves on the boards of two of his brother Elon's companies, Tesla and SpaceX, and whom Epstein introduced to a woman he had previously dated. Quote, it almost seemed a little more transactional, unquote, one source told Business Insider. Quote, the rumor has always been that Epstein facilitated introductions to beautiful women looking for deal flow or access to capital, unquote. Of course, close ties to the heavyweights of the tech sector carried considerable clout in terms of legitimizing Epstein in the eyes of Silicon Valley, and Epstein pulled out all the stops to win them over. He told the New York Times that even though Silicon Valley techies, quote, had a reputation for being geeky workaholics, unquote, he found that they were hedonistic and regular users of recreational drugs, and he personally witnessed, quote, prominent tech figures, unquote, taking drugs and setting up sexual assignations. It's unclear what, if anything, Epstein intended to do with that knowledge. According to Mother Jones, Epstein put together lavish dinner parties with the likes of paleontologist and evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould, and cognitive psychologist and linguist Steven Pinker as a way of creating his own quote-unquote mini-university. He had an extraordinary ability to assemble a group of great scientists and intellectuals, but in the end, of course, he had really bought his way into their world. Scientists liked sex and money as much as anyone. Joichi Ito, the former head of MIT's prestigious media lab, and Harvard biologist George Church, of the Human Genome Project, were among those who had support from or regular contact with Epstein. In September 2019, Ito resigned after acknowledging that he had received $1.7 million from Epstein including $1.2 million for his own outside investment funds. And ultimately, Epstein was Epstein. And when the conversation drifted outside his interests and he got bored, he was known to interrupt by referring to a topic that occupied his thoughts a great deal of the time. Quote, "What does that got to do with pussy?" unquote, he'd ask. End of section. So I think we'll leave it there in terms of reading for today and then pick this up. But we should note that it is very interesting as we were begin to research the background of like the Malibu Mafia and looking into the background of the original sort of highlighting of Assange and relationship to privacy and media and First Amendment that Paul Jay, the original co-founder of Real News, who we did a whole segment on about usually unspoken of other co-founder, Rabbi David Oestreicher, that Paul Jay held this panel, this crucial panel in Silicon Valley, I believe, that featured Daniel Ellsberg. What's his
Peter
name?
Peter Thiel was on this Thiel. Event.
And then there was a guy from the MIT Media Lab who was on there too. And so we will return to that. It's a crucial video, actually, to understand, I think, the current moment. And so it's interesting this MIT Media Lab is represented there at this crucial time. I think it was from 2013.
2010, time.
Yeah, period. You're right, Greg.
I think, and Paul Jay was playing like devil, was playing like the neutral man between this this MIT guy and then the person I forget the person who there was some interesting discourse of Paul Jay being like a straight man in the middle of these interactions with some of the people on this panel.
Definitely. So we will return to that, and we will we're almost heading towards the close of this chapter, and then we will then get to the next chapter, which dives deeper into John Mark Dugin, and then how he ends up in Russia, his relationship with Pavel Borodin all the way back from 2013, and so that will help fill in some of the gaps in terms of the question of who all has this kompromat. That I think continues to be one of, if not the most crucial, deep political question surrounding the unresolved matters of Epstein Maxwell.
Indeed.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Greg, for doing this morning.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, everybody. We appreciate you. Until next time, Antidote, we are out.